Good morning, Your Honor. Howard Crystal for the appellants, and I'll reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This case concerns the threat that ship strikes pose to the North Atlantic right whale, one of the most critically imperiled whale species in the world, whose population is so low that the death of a single whale could doom the species to extinction. This morning, I'll first address plaintiff's claim against the National Marine Fisheries Service, or NMFS, and then turn to plaintiff's claims against the Coast Guard, as to which there's a threshold standing issue. 3 years ago, the plaintiff submitted an APA rulemaking petition to NMFS seeking regulations that would regulate ship speeds in right whale habitat in light of a dramatic rise in ship strikes of right whales. The National Marine Fisheries Service, NMFS, agreed that ship speed regulations would dramatically reduce the risks of these ship strikes, but the agency denied the petition for emergency regulations on the grounds that resources would be better spent pursuing permanent ship speed rules.
And what was the standard of review of the district court in reviewing that decision?
Well, Your Honor, it would be arbitrary and capricious review under the APA. And I think that
involves a substantial component of deference to the agency's allocation of its resources.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
In fact, I think there are cases that say the agency's discretion is at its zenith.
It is at its zenith. That's correct as well.
We have a district judge who found that the agency had not acted arbitrarily or capriciously and deferred to the discretion.
That's correct.
What is our standard of review in reviewing this?
Well, Your Honor, I think the Supreme Court in the Mass v. EPA case and this court in a long line of cases, including Ling, has made clear that while a review of a denial of a rulemaking petition is highly deferential, nonetheless, the agency has to comply with the fundamental obligation to provide a reasoned explanation for its decision in light of its statutory mandates. So to answer Your Honor's question,
you're dealing now, the long line of cases does not deal with emergencies.
That's correct.
You've got a rather steeper hill to climb than if this were the
admittedly so
decision. Yeah, this is a decision to proceed with normal course of events rather than to act in an emergency.
There is
not a long line of cases in which the courts have reversed the decisions of agencies in that regard. I think there have been one or two, maybe.
I think that's correct as well, Your Honor. We do not.
That's a pretty stiff hill to climb.
I agree, Your Honor. I don't dispute that. But the question here, Your Honor, again, admitting that steep hill we have to climb is whether the agency has met its basic obligation, where, again, the agency's rationale was that it could avoid delay in promulgating permanent regulations by not pursuing emergency regulations.
Emergency petition was denied.
3 years ago, Your Honor.
3 years ago.
And there still are no permanent regulations in effect.
Yeah, and the status of the case now is that they're awaiting OMB approval?
With regard to the regulations, the permanent ship speed rules, our understanding is they've been submitted to OMB. That's correct.
And if OMB approved them tomorrow,
mm-hmm.
would this case be moot?
Yes.
Okay.
With regard to NMFS.
If OMB rejected them tomorrow, would this case how would that affect this case?
I think it would still leave open the question, and in fact,
the review of the regulation would be unright, wouldn't it?
No, again, it's
You'd
important
have
to
go back and start in the district court, wouldn't you then?
Your Honor, just to clarify,
I'm hiding the ball too much on you. The reason I asked the second,
yes.
Obviously, if OMB approves the regulations, this case is moot. If OMB refuses to approve, I ask you, how would that affect this case? And the reason I ask that is that the way I read the executive order requiring OMB approval, OMB also has to approve interim regs. So if they won't approve the final regs, then I can't see any basis for assuming they're going to approve the interim.
Well, Your Honor,
the interim are supposed to be in effect until the final takes.
I understand the court's concern, and just to clarify. Let me just answer that particular question, which is there is a provision in the executive order at Section 6A, which allows an agency to go ahead when it thinks there's an emergency.
Yeah, but I don't think that covers it.
Well, the question would be, Your Honor, in that situation and in the situation we find ourselves in right now, whether in light of the agency's own assessment, the agency agrees, there's no dispute in the record, that ship speed restrictions would dramatically reduce the risks of these ship speed restrictions dramatically reduce the risk of ship strikes.
Have there been any scientific studies in the interim that might give OMB pause about that?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. Not that I'm aware of. I don't want to spend too much time on the NMFS issue.
Yeah.
I understand, Your Honor. Let me just close by saying that in our view, the agency did not at all explain why it was making this trade-off at the time it denied the emergency petition, was required to at least analyze to some extent how much quicker it could finish the permanent regulatory process.
They're going ahead with permanent regulations, President.
Well, unfortunately, Your Honor, they're not, because they proposed them, but we don't know when, if ever, they'll be finalized.
Yeah, that's right. We don't know.
If OMB is not going to act on the permanent regulations, is just holding them up, for whatever the reason is, it's not in the record, you know, why are we to assume that OMB would not do the same with the interim?
Well, again, all I can say, Your Honor, is we don't know. And given the record right now, we're asking for a reasoned explanation about the emergency regulations.
And sure. And is it your position that the explanation that that the agency gave for not having the interim rule, that it would slow up the final rule, even if it were valid at some point, it's certainly not valid today?
Well, that's exactly right, Your Honor. That's exactly right.
Slow it up? I mean, for goodness sake, it's been years.
That's our position, Your Honor.
If there is a proceeding for permanent regulations out there, why should the courts be involved at this point in emergency regulations?
Well,
how emergent is it 3 years after your request and when there's an ongoing rulemaking with regard to permanent regulations?
Well, unfortunately, Your Honor, it's become even more of an emergency since that time, but I understand the court's concern. Turning to the plaintiff's claim against the Coast Guard, that claim concerns Section 7 of the Endangered Species Act, which requires that whenever an agency takes an action, authorized funds or carries out an action that may affect endangered species, it's required to consult with the expert agency, which here again is NIMS, to ensure that that action is not likely to jeopardize species. Plaintiffs have claimed that the Coast Guard's traffic separation schemes require consultation. Now, the Coast Guard has raised a threshold standing argument, which I'd like to address first. In particular, the Coast Guard says that because marine vessels can choose whether or not to travel in these traffic separation schemes, there's no causation here. But, Your Honors, that is contradicted by the Coast Guard's own actions, where it recently moved the Boston traffic separation scheme precisely to protect right whales. And in their own brief, they acknowledge that it will result in a 58% reduction, that's on page 15 of their brief, of ship strikes by moving that traffic separation scheme. The record reflects the agency's acknowledgement that, quote, extensive research demonstrates and supports the need to amend the TSS, that's the Boston Traffic Separation Scheme, to help protect right whales. That's at page 618 of the Joint Appendix. So on this record, we don't see how there's any standing issue with regard to the relationship between traffic separation schemes and ship strikes. The Coast Guard's other standing argument is really their merits argument, which is that traffic separation schemes are not established by the Coast Guard but by the IMO. This court has long precedent, including Florida Audubon, which says that the court presumes the plaintiff's theory on the merits for standing purposes. So I'd like to turn now to the merits issues, which again is the Coast Guard's argument that when it codifies traffic separation schemes in the Code of Federal Regulations through notice and comment rulemaking, it is carrying out a decision made by an international body, the International Maritime Organization, which is a UN agency. And our position is that this court should follow the statute, not this agency practice, which it asks this court to follow. Here, the agency's organic statute provides, and here I'm quoting from Section 1223 of the Ports and Waterways Safety Act, that the Coast Guard shall designate necessary fairways and traffic separation schemes. Section 1223C5 requires that the Coast Guard issue regulations promulgating traffic separation schemes, and Section 1230D provides that after the Coast Guard promulgates these schemes, they're to be transmitted to international bodies for potential adoption as international standards. The Coast Guard's argument is that it doesn't follow this scheme, that it's engaged in some practice of letting the IMO adopt traffic separation schemes, and that's wrong both as a matter of law and as a matter of fact in this case. Again, as the law is that the statute provides for the Coast Guard to set these schemes, and the Supreme Court's recent Medellin case reinforces the point that an agency cannot simply assert that some international body has the power to set domestic law.
This is under Section 7A2, is that what you—
That's correct, Your Honor. Under? Yes. And it's important to recognize the scope of the agency's argument from a legal perspective, which is that, again, there's no authority for anybody to bring a claim challenging a traffic separation scheme. As I mentioned, the Coast Guard recently moved the Boston scheme to protect right whales, adding approximately 22 minutes to vessel travel time. This would mean that the shipping industry, of course, could not challenge that scheme under the provision of the Ports and Waterways Safety Act, Section 1224, which mandates that the Coast Guard consider economic impacts in setting these schemes. And we don't believe that Congress anticipated in assigning the agency this responsibility that there would be no judicial review of these schemes. The record also contradicts the agency's argument. The record reflects that in the agency's rulemakings, it acknowledges, and now I'm quoting from page 629 of the Joint Appendix, that it is acting under the authority of the Ports and Waterways Safety Act when it enacts traffic separation schemes. And the CFR, this is 33 CFR 167.1, says that the purpose of what the agency is doing in the CFR is establishing and designating traffic separation scheme. That's a quote, not carrying out the decision of the International Maritime Organization. It even puts these schemes out for public comment, again, evincing an agency's own understanding that it is acting pursuant to domestic law, not pursuant to some international law. So our position in this case is that because the agency is carrying out a domestic statutory obligation, and there is no authority for the agency to do what it claims to be doing, which is carrying out the decision of an international body, that this court should require that the agency follow the basic Section 7A2 consultation process.
What's the code citation on that?
For the Ports and Waterways Safety Act?
Yeah,
it's 33 U.S.C. Section 1223.
Keep going to the subparts.
Okay, 1223C1, and this is on page 66 of the addendum to our brief. So if you look at page 66, it says the Coast Guard shall designate necessary fairways and traffic separation schemes. And also on that page 66, 1223C5.
That was one section off.
I'm sorry.
I was looking at it. It was my fault.
When is this consultation supposed to occur, according to you?
Well, that's a good question, Your Honor. Of course, our preference, and we think that the case law makes clear that it should occur early in the process. Of course, the earlier it occurs, the more it can inform the agency's decision-making. Now here—
Before the Coast Guard promulgates the traffic separation whatevers?
Well, certainly before it makes a final decision. It'd be too late afterwards.
Before they make a recommendation to the IMO?
Well, Your Honor, I guess what I would say is that certainly with regard to the rulemaking itself, we would say that at some appropriate juncture before a final rule is promulgated. Now, with regard to your particular question, it is our position that when the Coast Guard if the Coast Guard decides to follow this particular process, which we are disputing that the Coast Guard goes to the IMO to get approval before it makes its final decision. But in our view, it would be incumbent on the agency to assess the impacts on an endangered species before it actually makes the proposal. Because if it waits until later, it obviously may realize after it's wasted the time and resources to go to the IMO that this particular scheme will endanger a listed species. So the Coast Guard has mischaracterized our argument. They've suggested that we're asking for consultation over these port access routing studies, which are internal agency studies about routing measures. That's not our point. Our point is that before the agency makes a final decision about a traffic separation scheme, at some appropriate juncture, the agency has to go through this process to ensure that its actions, that it carries out, that it funds, that it authorizes.
I have a comment on your oral argument is so much more effective than your brief. I don't know about the government. You know why? Because instead of saying TSS and N whatever, and you're not giving an oral argument an acronym.
I don't have a word limit on my oral argument, Your Honor. That's why.
That sounds like an admission. What we have always expected about the use of acronyms.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. I'll just close here, I think, by
However, there is one error that I want to point out to you. You've glided by it, but the district court said there was no final agency action. You took the district court to task, saying that Bennett versus Speer dispenses with that, and there's a footnote on page 34 of your brief quoting Bennett versus Speer. I think you've quoted Bennett versus Speer in a passage that proves just the opposite.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute, Your Honor.
Here's what the Supreme Court said, okay? It said, interpreting the term violation to include any errors on the part of the Secretary in administering the Endangered Species Act would affect a wholesale abrogation of the APA's final agency action requirement. And now, the sentence that you quoted, any procedural default, even one that had not yet resulted in a final disposition of the matter, would form the basis for a lawsuit. You say that's the law. The Supreme Court is saying that can't be the law because it would abrogate final agency action.
The Supreme Court was saying that, Your Honor, in the context of a claim against the Secretary of Interior for administering the Endangered Species Act. The court was concerned about subsection C of the Act, which limited claims against the Secretary for violations of Section 4. And the court, in addition to having that concern about overlapping authorizations, made the point Your Honor has highlighted, which is that this would allow judicial review of actions that might not be final agency action. But Your Honor, our claim in this case is under Section 1540 G1A. Of the Endangered Species Act, which in Bennett versus Speer, this is on page 173, the court says that that section is a means, and I'm quoting, by which private parties may enforce the substantive provisions of the ESA against regulated parties, both private entities and government agencies. The claim under section 1540 G1A is a claim for a violation of the act. Final agency action is not implicated. And the Supreme Court has said in several cases, including the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance case, this is in section 2 of that case, quote, where no other statute provides a private right of action, the agency action must be final agency action. In this case, we are bringing a citizen suit claim under section 7A2. And the only limit on our claim is whether or not the Congress has authorized a claim against an agency action. And under 7A2, it requires that the agency engage in consultation for any action. Excuse me.
Well, the agency action here, it gets a little muddied. The agency action here that you're talking about is, well, what is it? Is it the Coast Guard's promulgation of the regulation?
That's right. The other answer to your original question is we think it's kind of a red herring in this case because everything they're doing is final. So there's no dispute. There's nothing interlocutory here. Again, we're not challenging the port access routing studies. That's the premise of their final agency action
and
argument.
What's the remedy? What's the remedy? Is it that the regulation that these transportation separation schemes have to be nullified?
That's not what we've asked for, Your Honor, and that's not what we asked the district court. What we want is for the agency to go through the process, ultimately evaluate what the impacts, as they just did in Boston, but not going through Section 7A2. And if they find that one of these schemes are jeopardizing species under the process, 7A2 process, NIMS would come up with what's called a reasonable and prudent alternative. Again, it's very analogous to what happened in Boston, but they haven't followed the 7A2 process, and that's what we're asking to require them to do. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Sam Sankar for the United States Government. National Marine Fisheries Service and the United States Coast Guard both acknowledged the threat that ship strikes pose to the right whale populations, but plaintiff's legal claims against these agencies are misplaced. First, I'll speak briefly to the claim against the National Marine Fisheries Service. As this Court has already recognized, the standard of review here is extremely tough for the plaintiffs to overcome, and in this case, it's especially difficult since the agency was already pursuing the very same sort of rulemaking activity that the plaintiffs
were. Pursuing it, according to reports, they sent their final rule to OMB in February of 2007. What are they pursuing now?
I think the first thing we should note is that this case involves a denial of a petition that was done in September 2005. And when this court evaluates that decision, it evaluates the decision on the facts that the agency had at the time. Now, there's a lot has happened since then, but again, what we're reviewing is the district court's analysis of the denial that happened in 2005. And at that time, I don't think plaintiffs would dispute that there was a lot of activity going on at the National Marine Fisheries Service, and a lot of it was directed to the right whale ship strike reduction program.
So if they filed another emergency request for a interim rulemaking tomorrow, the agency wouldn't have a leg to stand on, would it? The agency is going to say, "Well, we're really wrapped up in this, you know, this rulemaking that we had that we sent to OMB a year and a half ago, and we're sitting there, you know, sitting on our hands waiting for OMB to. We don't have time to fool around with an interim rig."
In fact, the plaintiffs have already filed such a petition. They filed it in January, and they asked for further emergency rulemaking.
What happened to that?
I don't know if this is if the plaintiffs have received word of it, but I asked the agency about that, and my understanding is that the agency plans to deny that and has put a letter in the mail. I don't know whether the plaintiffs have received it yet.
What is the letter?
I found out about
What's
this
the
on
letter
Friday.
Say?
The letter is fairly close. It's not in the record, Your Honor, and I believe it says it gives similar reasons to the case at hand, to the reasons why NIMS is not acting on the petition. I think we should make clear here that.
And you agree that if OMB denies or approves the regulation that's had pending before it for a year and a half, that this case is moot.
There's one caveat on that. First of all, the OMB process is not an approval or disapproval process. It's an interagency process that involves a lot of agencies that come to the table, among the Department of Defense, the Navy, a lot of organizations that have a lot of interest in these rules. So the process that's going on right now is not OMB locked in some office trying to decide whether the rule is going on. There's a lot of back and forth.
Under the executive order, it has the authority to review, right?
That's correct.
And it's still, after a year and a half, it's still reviewing.
I think that's correct, yes. In any event, as I said, I believe this court, again, should be reviewing the decision made in 2005 at the time. And as Your Honor suggested, the petition that is before the court, the petition that the plaintiffs filed in January would be a different matter, a different case, a different record. Moving on to the claim against the Coast Guard, the district court here recognized the key fact that matters. The TSSs at issue in this case were all adopted by the International Maritime Organization.
What do you do with the statutory obligation in 1223C1 that the Coast Guard shall designate the necessary separations?
The Coast Guard does have the authority to create TSSs on its own in certain areas, including territorial
obligation, to create TSS.
I won't argue with Your Honor that this statute could be read to create an obligation. However,
what's the other way it could be read? Shall be made?
If you read the Locke case, the United States versus Locke, which is a Supreme Court case looking at this, it says that this is not an obligation to create traffic separation schemes. It creates the authority. It doesn't create an affirmative obligation that they have to do it. I will say that.
What's the point of that?
The point of that is that there are other.
The point is they are doing it, yeah. and where is the statutory authority for the Coast Guard to act other than the section that Judge Sentelle just pointed out to you?
The Coast Guard is not acting pursuant to these things. The Coast Guard is enacting the regulations at the end of the day pursuant to this.
What if it's not these things?
The end of the day proposals that go into the CFR to say here are the traffic separation schemes that we are enacting in response to the IMO's adoption of this stuff is being done pursuant to the statute. But the President, using his foreign relations.
At the end of the case?
No, not at all, because at that point the agency does not have the discretion to change the TSSs from what the IMO has already done. Well, this is sort of like a road we're building a road, and the IMO has said, let's put the signs up this way, this way, and this way.
Get as far as an analogy as you can, and as close to the facts of this case.
When the IMO sets up.
What it's sort of like, tell me where the authority comes from in the statutes, if not in 1223C1.
The Coast Guard's authority to promulgate the regulations comes from the statute. But let's be clear, many of the TSSs in this issue were never put in the CFR. It's very hard for the plaintiffs to tell you where the final action comes from when many of these TSSs are not in the Code of Federal Regulations.
So if the IMO proposes to the Coast Guard a regulation that every scientist that has ever studied this will wipe out these whales. I mean, you're going to kill 10 a year. It's just going to plow them down, right? The Coast Guard has no discretion. It's got to promulgate that regulation.
Absolutely
despite
not.
Despite the fact that the Endangered Species Act requires just the opposite.
There's nothing in our treaty obligations that suggests that the IMO's authority extends to requiring the Coast Guard to mow down endangered species. What the treaty obligation suggests is that, as a matter of comity, we want the United States charts to reflect the same thing the international charts do. You don't want to put up two sets of road signs because you're going to cause shipping accidents.
But is that any more than precatory on the Coast Guard in the adoption of the separation?
I guess I don't understand your question, Your Honor.
Does that obligate the Coast Guard to enact precisely those schemes, or does the Coast Guard still have the 1223C1 authority to create separation?
I think we would say that the Coast Guard has theoretical authority to change the TSSs from what the IMO's adopted.
Authority?
I'm sorry, it has...
It's the same as legal authority?
I believe you could say it has legal authority, but it has no practical discretion. Because if the Coast Guard were to go out there and change the shipping schemes, you'd have one set of maps that said one thing and another set of maps that said another thing. This is the sort of thing that would get the United States in deep trouble with the international community and really impair our ability to use those international forums as means
for...
Are these
beyond the territorial limit?
Some of them, in fact, are. Yes, they're outside.
But what about the ones within the territorial limit? Why doesn't the United States control that entirely?
My understanding is, as a matter of our treaty obligations, we go to the IMO, we ask to make sure the other nations are giving input, and the IMO often says, look, we don't adopt this. Now, the U.S. can enact the TSS domestically, but for it to be adopted internationally and to be reflected on international charts, Chinese shipping vessels, Your Honor, don't carry the CFR.
Isn't it true that if, in fact, the Coast Guard treated the decision of the IMO as binding so that it had to promulgate the regulation, that would violate the Constitution because of the ratification clause? You're having an international body make law, domestic law, without having it approved by the Senate and signed off by the President.
So the premise to your question is that TSSs are law. TSSs are voluntary. TSSs are marks on charts that say, mariners, if you want to be safe, you'd be smart to go this way. Nobody is required to follow them, and indeed the Coast Guard does not go out there and police ships to make sure that they go in TSSs. This causes a real standing and a redressability problem for the plaintiffs, because in this case, if you were to vacate the TSSs that the Coast Guard has put in the regulation, which is, again, only three of them, many of them have never been codified in the CFR, nothing would change. The TSSs are out there, the IMO's adopted them, other sailors are following them. Taking them out of the CFR does nothing.
What do you say to the appellant's proposition that your own studies show that a huge percentage of the users of vessels would follow the TSSs and you'd have a reduction of 57% or something in the oil stress?
That's the Boston TSS, what I say is that there's certainly a practical effect to moving the TSSs. But to say that the Coast Guard has legal authority over these vessels is simply wrong. And in fact, there's case law that we've cited.
They have legal authority to set the TSS. And that legal authority doesn't mention, boy, we're using the separation schemes, and that doesn't mention the international bunch in the statute, right?
I'm very sorry, Your Honor. I guess I didn't quite understand your question.
Right. You do have the legal authority to set the TSS.
In domestic waters, yes.
Yeah. And the fact in the statute, there's no mention of the international body anyway.
There is a mention of the international body, but with respect to forwarding them.
223C1.
That's correct.
In the granting clause. So, for purposes of this litigation, the Coast Guard does have an authority to do what they're asking for.
Yes.
The redressability lies, and there's a lot of cases, I grant you, that say that where the relief is dependent upon the voluntary act of a third party, there is not redressability. I wrote a lot of those cases, but in none of them did we have the kind of practical study you have here that shows a practical effect. Isn't this different?
The practical effect, let's be clear here. The Boston TSS, the one that they're saying has 58 changes and reduces mortalities by 58%, is not in the CFR. You'd be hard-pressed, I suggest you ask the plaintiffs where the final action is with regards to these studies when all the Coast Guard has done is formulate a PAR study. Another thing, a factual matter that I want to clear up here, is it's not the Coast Guard that goes to the IMO to propose new TSSs. It is the United States government that does so. And the Coast Guard has no authority to engage in Foreign Relations Act on behalf of the United States.
At least as far as the waters under the jurisdiction of the United States, the international body doesn't have authority either, does it? I mean,
the international, many of the TSSs, it's not a, the entrance to TSSs, that is to say, they may start out in international waters. And with respect to that, it's very important to put this whole case is really about a practical thing here. Again, these things are voluntary. You want the charts, all of the charts, to show the same thing. If the Coast Guard were to promulgate separation schemes that said one thing and the international chart said something else, you'd have shipping accidents. That is, there is no real discretion for the Coast Guard.
Does the Coast Guard promulgate these or make their recommendations or whatever? is the Coast Guard totally oblivious to the right whales when it does all this?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
Who are they? Who is the Coast Guard? The Coast Guard is not expert, I take it, in protecting whales. So who does the Coast Guard consult?
The Coast Guard has been talking to National Marine Fisheries Service pursuant to a specific congressional command that you'll see in the appended to the plaintiff's reply brief. So as a result of that command, the Coast Guard went out, did a study.
The plaintiffs are asking you just simply to formalize something the Coast Guard is already doing.
That's another way of putting it. In fact,
why are you fighting this?
Because there are programmatic aspects to this as well. The Coast Guard does not believe that the mere publication of a PARS, a study, triggers Section 7 obligations. And similarly, the optional, what's frankly optional publication in the CFR of where a routing scheme is, which is just a notification act. It's an act of tacking up the notice on the board to mariners and saying, by the way, here's where the scheme is. The Coast Guard, if this court were to say you have an obligation that is triggered by the publication of that regulation in the CFR, the Coast Guard could simply stop doing it and nothing would change.
Let me ask you a very discreet question. What was the Supreme Court case you cited a moment ago with reference to the 223?
It's United States versus Locke, L-O-C-K-E, and I'm sorry, it's not cited in the briefs. It came up as a result of looking at the plaintiff's reply brief.
Is that in the reply brief?
No, it's a response to an argument.
Give me the cite for that, please.
I will in a moment. I have it at my desk.
I don't
have
it. And give it to me while we're talking. I know we're using your time, but you're the one who came up with the case. It's not in any of the briefs.
Your Honor, I'll have to confess that I don't actually have
the
case with me.
Locke.
United States versus L-O-C-K-E, Locke.
L-O-C-K-E.
It's a case from Washington involving a preemption question involving the PWSA, the Ports and Waterways Safety Act. Want to move on to another point here, and that is that there's a line of cases suggesting that where consultation under the ESA or any other environmental statute is simply of no use to the agency that's promulgating the regulation in question, the environmental statute is not usually held to apply. And the lead case on this is Public Citizen versus Department of Transportation, a Supreme Court case from a few years ago. And in that case, what the court says is that sometimes the decisions that an agency is implementing are someone else's, either the president's or conceivably in this case, one of an international organization. And in those cases, asking them to evaluate the effects of their ministerial act at the back end of that decision is simply, it doesn't make sense because the agency shouldn't be considered the cause of the action in question. In the ESA specifically, there's a couple of regulations that I think spell this requirement out a little bit. 402.03 is a regulation that says that where there's no discretionary federal involvement or control over a given act, then the ESA doesn't generally, the Section 7 requirements don't generally get triggered. There's a number of cases we've cited in our brief, the Babbitt versus Sierra Club, and the Marbled Murrelet case, in which courts have said, look, the agency doesn't really control this. It's just carrying out an action, and that doesn't trigger the Section 7 requirements. In fact, this case is easier than those because, as we've said, the Coast Guard doesn't even have to do anything here. When the IMO acts, the TSS is as real as it's ever going to be. Putting it in the CFR does not make it any more forceful than it would
but
otherwise
it's not
be.
You said that before, that all the Coast Guard doesn't have to put it in the CFR, but that doesn't make it any less action by the Coast Guard when the Coast Guard announces approval or notifies U.S. ships that here is the traffic scheme. Whether it's published in the CFR is a matter of the Federal Register Act, but we're not looking at the Federal Register Act. We're looking at the APA.
To think that the Section 7 requirements of the APA are triggered every time an agency simply posts a notice of some action by another body, it would be a good question to say what the actual, if one were to believe that that discrete act constituted an act that triggered Section 7 requirements, our argument would be that the only thing you would have.
Has the Coast Guard ever simply just posted the notice without saying that, you know, that without signing off on it?
I don't believe the Coast Guard ever signs off on these things at all. What happens is the Coast Guard publishes them in the CFR. Sometimes it doesn't even do that, as I've said. Sometimes it simply puts them out in local Mariner newsletters and says, by the way, a new TSS has been adopted, as, for example, in Boston. We're not putting it in the CFR. We don't need to because it's as effective as it is ever going to be.
Has been adopted by who?
IMO, the International Maritime Organization. The International Maritime Organization adopted the new separation scheme in Boston in July of 2007.
The Coast Guard has its own authority within territorial waters, right?
That's correct.
And if they're saying, here's the TSS for wherever within the three-mile limit, isn't that, in effect, adopting it?
Well, it would be if there were any practical effect to it. Again, the very fact that the Coast Guard doesn't have to do it makes it hard to see how that's any kind of action that would trigger a Section 7 requirement. And if it were, I think the only effect that one could attribute would be the incremental effect of having the Coast Guard publish the notice, which I would submit is absolutely zero. Publishing the notice doesn't change where the mariners are going.
We recommend you go this way. That's not final agency action?
When the IMO has already recommended the very same thing and the charts already
right.
say the same thing, it very well may be final agency action. We're not disputing that publishing the regulations is final agency action. What I'm suggesting is that it cannot possibly trigger a consultation requirement, because the Coast Guard isn't exercising any discretion in its placement of that TSS.
The purpose of the consultation is to minimize the damage to an endangered species. And if the Coast Guard is just playing ventriloquist dummy for the IMO, you say it wouldn't have any practical effect. Well, maybe the consultation would. And maybe a biological opinion, maybe the assessment might say, well, you know, we would have tweaked this thing. Is the IMO concerned with the whale? Do they do studies of the effect on the
whale? The IMO does not do studies. What happens is the Coast Guard does a PARA study at the initial point, and I believe plaintiffs have stepped away from the idea of saying that the PARA study triggers any Section 7A requirements in and of itself. So the only thing they can be saying is that the publication of the separation scheme in the CFR does so. And at that point, I would submit, there is no discretion. Again, as I've said before, the Coast Guard can't go out and put new road signs up that contradict the ones that are already on the charts. Briefly stepping to the PARS studies, to the extent the plaintiffs suggest that the PARS studies are in fact worthy of consultation in and of themselves, I want to point out that, as Your Honor said, those aren't final agency actions for purposes of APA review.
What does PARS mean?
A port access route study, and I'm sorry to use the acronyms. It's the result
What's
of
SHC?
The Shipping Coordinating Committee, and that one is not.
How did that get to SHC?
I wish you'd been in my moot court on Friday, Your Honor. I asked the very same question, and nobody knew the answer. It is an advisory.
It would have been nice if you put that in the glossary. It's not even in the glossary. It took me half an hour to figure out what that was.
My apologies, Your Honor. Yeah. My apologies on that. I recognize that my time's expired.
Yeah, well, right. While you're back on things you didn't put in the glossary, let's go back to that case you didn't put in the brief. Well, you were citing it a moment ago for the proposition that 1223C1 is precatory rather than mandatory?
No, that the requirement to go out and publish TSS regulations is not mandatory. There's a line that I believe.
Shall designate is not mandatory, what you say. The Locke case dealt with 1223A. It was not even construing the language of 1223C1.
I'm referring to the overall requirement to publish TSS regulations. Now, I believe that you'd have to. Let's put it this way. Let me step back for a moment.
That was a preemption question on the Ports and Waterways Act, and it dealt only with 1223S.
Your Honor, I don't have the case in front of me, so let me say something.
You decide a case that you haven't shown us before. It'd be a good idea if you had it in front of you.
Fair enough, Your Honor. Let me point out something else. The plaintiffs here have not asked for injunctive relief to ask the Coast Guard to publish TSSs or to do anything else. What they've said is
a consultation for the Coast Guard.
That's very fair, and they can ask for a consultation, but they have not asked the Coast Guard to publish these TSSs. So saying to the Coast Guard or highlighting the statutory obligation, if indeed Your Honor interprets it as such, is not enough. That's not what this case is. That's not what this complaint is about.
No, but it's what your defense is about, because you keep saying the Coast Guard doesn't have to do this. They rather have to do what IMO tells them.
The fact that a statute allows, it says an agency shall do this, doesn't preclude the fact that there might be another way to do the very same thing. For example, if some other agency...
How much would that help you? The statute says you shall do this, and another statute says, 7A says you shall consult before you do this. How much does it help you if they have some other obligation to also consult with the agency?
I think that helps us a great deal, because if, for example...
Why couldn't they consult under 7A and go to the IMO?
What I'm suggesting is that there are other avenues for creating TSSs other than having the Coast Guard do it. And as a result, for example, if another agency had the authority to do it, such as the IMO, and the Coast Guard had no involvement whatsoever in it, it would mean, make no sense at all to say the Coast Guard should...
That's not the world we have for this case.
What I'm saying is the Coast Guard need have no involvement at all for a TSS to be created. So having it consult makes no sense either. Your Honor, my time's expired and...
Right, counsel, there are lots of times when an agency has an option, but most of the time, whether or not to take an action. That doesn't absolve it from consulting under 7A before it makes that decision, does it?
That's
your
fair.
It seems to sweep an awful lot into the dustpan with it.
But again, the only TSSs that the Coast Guard has done anything with in this case are three TSSs in the southeastern United States. Many of the ones here were never put into the CFR at all. And again, my point stands that if there's no remedy in this case, if you say to the Coast Guard, you've got to consult, the Coast Guard says, before we do what? And if it's before we promulgate TSSs, they could vacate the TSSs.
But they also could consult.
That is fair, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, counsel. The case, well, I'm sorry, time for rebuttal. Did he have any time left? Okay.
I'll take him, Your Honor. Thank
Go
you.
Ahead,
Your Honor, just briefly on the NIMS point, we, of course, have now just learned that they've denied our new petition for emergency rulemaking. They proposed the proposed rule after we moved for summary judgment. They promised the district court that the rule would come out a year ago. And I just wanted to cite one case to the court, Amoco Oil, which is at 501 F. 2nd at 729. This court did say that the court can look to future events in certain circumstances in analyzing the appropriateness and reasonableness of an agency's decision. Turning on to the Coast Guard claims, again, as the court has highlighted, the statute requires that the Coast Guard designate these schemes. And as we pointed out in our reply brief, although the following traffic separation schemes is voluntary, there are important legal presumptions which flow. We cited some cases in our reply brief at page 11 about that. So because they have legal effect, that's the reason that mariners follow these schemes. And it's entirely consistent with the Coast Guard's activities under the international process, the way the statute operates. Again, Section 1224 also provides that the agency will go to the international body after it makes these decisions. In addition, with regard to the Coast Guard's authority, Section 1224A of the statute lists factors the agency must consider, including protection of the marine environment. And finally, with regard to these traffic separation schemes that have not been codified in the CFR, again, the agency suggests here today that it doesn't do anything. Well, if you look at 33 CFR Part 62 and 72, it outlines a whole host of activities the agency engages in with regard to these schemes, even the ones that are not codified. And Section 402, of this is 50 CFR 402.02, defines agency action as including all activity or programs of any kind authorized, funded, or carried out by the agency. And the activities here with regard to codified traffic separation schemes and non-codified traffic separation schemes are activities of the agency which require consultation under Section 782. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted. We're going to take a brief recess to let the courtroom empty itself, then we're going to reconvene for a ceremonial.